The exponents of Buddhism declare that Buddhism is concerned with the happiness of man. And not only the exponents, but the founder himself declares this. Let me just read to you first what the Dalai Lama says in this book of his, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye. Our highest duty as human beings is to search out a means whereby beings may be freed from all kinds of sufferings or unsatisfactory experience. This desire for happiness is not only found in the man of learning and intelligence, but among all creatures in the world, even the most insignificant. The desire for happiness. As it stands, that sounds very hedonistic. Happiness? Yes, of course. Everyone will shout. Hoopy, this is the stuff for me. I want to be happy. Here is a discourse of the Buddha speaking to Ananda. And he describes the different states of consciousness when you go into meditation. And in relation to each one of them, he says, this is a greater happiness than the one before. And when he comes to the very end, he says, here, Ananda, a monk, by wholly transcending the plane of neither perception nor non-perception, enters and abides in the stopping of feeling and perceiving. This, Ananda, is the other happiness that is more excellent and exquisite than that happiness, referring to the previous stage. And it is perfectly clear that happiness in the Buddhist sense, happiness in the religious sense, has nothing to do with pleasure. It has nothing to do with the sensational life. This happiness is a state of being which is realized when the person is totally unselfed. Because in that state, which the Buddha calls the stopping of feeling and perception, the separate I, seeking this, seeking the other, grasping at this, that or the other, has completely vanished. In terms of consciousness, of course, the body is there, naturally. Now, if we look really carefully inside ourselves, we will find that this urge to happiness exists in some one or other of the innumerable forms in which the urge to happiness expresses itself. That which obstructs is we ourselves as we are. And when I say we ourselves as we are, I am including our environment. Because there's no such thing as a person by himself, taken out of the context of the world in which he lives. We would be non-existent in double quick time if the not-self, the outside world, the environment, were to disappear. Why? If the environment disappeared, there'd be no air to breathe, we'd be dead. So we are constantly in relationship with an environment. And the lives of all human beings have, in some measure or other, so much misery, frustration. Now you may recall, last time we touched upon the various defilements of the mind that the Buddha spoke of. That these defilements are powerful obstructions to the realization of true happiness. And of course, the problem arises again and again. What do I do in relation to these defilements? I say, what do I do? But the way in which the question arises in one's mind, the usual way, is how do I get rid of the defilements? When we use the word defilements, we think in terms of vice and virtue. And it is a noticeable feature of all the religions of the world, including the orthodox conventional presentation of Buddhism, that one is exhorted to fight the good fight, to get rid of evil, to increase, develop, and bring to fruition the good. And we also saw last time, to a certain degree, that the outlook of striving against the evil contains within itself the seeds of fresh evil. Whatsoever the mind formulates as a desirable goal is in itself already tainted, because my mind, to start with, is by no means the pure and the perfect mind. Therefore, whatsoever it pictures, whatsoever it conceives, will bear the impress of this taint. And therefore, the goal, so-called, will always contain within itself the seeds of its disruption, its decay and its death. This is an extremely important point to bear in mind. Also, it engenders conflict. It engenders exclusiveness. This is the desirable, that is the undesirable. But the fact of my existence is, the fact of anybody's existence is, that he exists in the whole world, not in a part of it. And the whole world contains what we commonly call good and evil in various measures. It is everlastingly there. And these two are in conflict. Now, good and evil as such do not exist as entities on their own in the world. Good and evil are my observation and my reactions, my psychological reaction to what actually is. If I see it in terms of my psychological reactions, I am not seeing wisely or truly. I am seeing purely in terms of my weaknesses, really, and in terms of a perpetual conflict, a perpetual separating out from the wholeness of that which is. Therefore, how can we make anything like approach, anything like the right approach to the whole situation. We talked about it last time, but this is so important. It so touches everyone's life intimately, deeply, that it is worthwhile considering it again and again. How shall we make, or try to make, the right approach? It is essential to understand certain deep facts of the psychological life and of the process of the psyche. Our problem arises because we are conscious of the duality. This is pleasant, this is unpleasant. This I call good, that I call evil. In other words, my psyche is constantly bound within the limits of ambivalence. Kindness, cruelty, miserliness, generosity, and so forth. And within this sphere of duality, each dual holds its opposite within itself. This is the extraordinary and the tricky part of the situation. My kindness holds within itself also cruelty. And my cruelty holds within itself my kindness. It's a very curious thing. Because what I call cruel, or what a human being ordinarily calls cruel, is denominated as such in terms of opposition to kindness. And vice versa. See, this is something which we must see very clearly. It's very difficult to see this. Extremely difficult. Because we say, obviously, but that was violence, and this is kindness. Yes, indeed. But you see, when I say this is kindness, this was a kind act, I am saying that by abstracting this particular act from other kinds of action. By abstracting it. But life is lived in terms of the totality. I can't escape the totality. I cannot abstract in that manner. Don't we know? Kindness, what we call that, or rather, what we call kindness in one context would really be cruelty in another context, wouldn't it? Take one of the simple examples which we can see all over the world. This parent is an indulgent parent. And we say, oh, how very kind he is to his child, you see. But he goes to such an extent with that kindness that he's spoiling that child, and he's really being cruel to the child's future thereby. In preventing it from growing with an understanding of right relationship with others and with his circumstance. He is being spoiled. Or take the opposite case. The child who is constantly repressed, now behave properly, don't do this, don't do the other, you must be considerate of others. Well, of course the poor little child is, you might as well treat it like a chicken and wring its neck. Mightn't you? So you see, our definitions of the qualities are ill definitions. We really don't understand the nature of this ambivalence in which the psyche functions. It's very important to appreciate this ambivalence. What we call love and what we call hate, exist entirely within the sphere of duality, and there is no escape out of it. As such, there is no, escape is not a very good word, there is no transcending the limitations imposed upon us by duality. Duality as a physical fact in relationship to our body, our organism, unquestionably exists and will continue to exist as long as this organism is this kind of body. Simplest example, heat and cold. This organism being what it is, at an ordinary temperature of 98.4 degrees Fahrenheit, will feel that as cold and that as hot. That kind of duality can never be eliminated. You see? And it's not necessary to do so. But this other duality within the psyche, which binds the psyche within the sphere of duality, this is the source of our conflicts, of our confusions, our fears, our antagonisms, and all the rest of it, our misery in short, this ambivalence. Therefore, we have to understand the situation this way. Not that we have to got to get rid of an unpleasant quality, but to be free of the whole of the ambivalent sphere. To be free of it. We've got to be equally free of what we call, what we ordinarily call kindness, as well as what we ordinarily call cruelty. Then all our action, physical and psychological, will be essentially right. Free of the label kindness or cruelty. Is that understood, really understood? To this essential rightness, when you are free of ambivalence, the persons who are, people who are not free of ambivalence will give names. Oh, that person's so kind. Oh, that person's so stern. You see? But the person actually is free of ambivalence. True rightness cannot be seen and measured by one who is still a little bit blind. It cannot be seen. Take, for example, the life of Jesus. Here he was, the Lord of love. He healed, he raised people from the dead, as the story goes. On the other hand, he had no hesitation in saying, "You hypocrites, you vipers," and so on. And he was stern and severe and all the rest of it, wasn't he? This is how the story is put. And with what insight that story is put, when it is put that way, provided we can see the insight. Take the case of the Buddha. He who was all gentleness, all compassion, all wisdom, when he's talking to his own bhikkhus, if they have done wrong, he doesn't hesitate to tell them, "You foolish man, you have done terrible evil. It would be better for you that so and so, such and such a organ of your body or limb or whatever it is, burnt in red hot coals than that you should have done such a thing." Inquisition. But this is what he says. Now try and picture the situation. One who has complete understanding and compassion does not get into a rage and explode at his disciple. You can see him perfectly calm, perfectly compassionate, enfolding that disciple in his aura, shall we say, of love and wisdom, telling him the fact in quiet, measured terms, but sparing no superlatives. If he wants to tell him that he has done a terrible evil, he will say so. And if he has to praise the one, he will say, well done, well said. Time and again in the discourses you find, well said, Sariputta, well said, Ananda, or well said, whoever it is, and so forth. The liberated beings, like the Buddha and Jesus, are free of the bondage of ambivalence. This ambivalence is the sort of shell, hard shell, which shuts in the psyche, shuts in our understanding and vision. So now, if we have seen that clearly, then we will appreciate this other point. All the great teachers taught that it is indispensable for spiritual unfolding to exercise complete mindfulness, complete attentiveness, complete and intense. It must have a white hot intensity about it. This does not mean being emotional about it in any way, but to be wholly attentive, intensely attentive, calm, the mind in perfect equanimity as it watches. Now the point we must understand is this. If you watch with that intensity what we with our ambivalent outlook and in our ambivalent state call kindness, not only will this limited thing, kindness, vanish, but its opposite simultaneously will vanish, cruelty. If you can pay complete and total attention in the right way to cruelty, not only will cruelty vanish, but kindness. Not only generosity, but miserliness will vanish. You see, we declare hate is evil, love is good. Therefore, get rid of hate, cultivate love. This is a mistake. You can't do it that way. Love is not love, which is bound within the ambivalent sphere of love-hate as a conflicting duality. It is a transcendent thing. It is transcendent. We give the name love. We haven't words in the language to describe or stand for this transcendent reality. We choose the words love, wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, and all the rest of it because they are the pleasant words, you see, and they are meaningful to us in the sense of fulfillment, in the sense of growth, in the sense of peace and happiness and so forth, of deeper humanity, of godliness, if you like. That is why we choose those words. That is all. But the words which we choose as experienced and known in our own consciousness as we are wholly inadequate terms because they are within this state of duality. Our love includes our hate. Our generosity includes our miserliness. You see? Now, if there is complete attentiveness not only does it transform the psychical energy which is expressing itself as hate, but it also does away with love as an opposite to hate. You are free of both. You are free, in short, of the whole sphere of ambivalence. This is true psychological healing. This is real psychiatry. And as far as I can see, it is the only real psychiatry. It is the real understanding of the psyche. But to have such understanding, oneself must be a liberated being. The doctor in the flesh, healing or giving medicine for some ailment of the flesh, himself may suffer from it horribly. It's not necessary for him to be the perfectly healthy body. But in the case of the psyche, the perfectly healthy psyche alone can help the unhealthy psyche to become whole. But it is not necessary, not absolutely necessary, to go to another for this. Oneself, out of one's own self, because one cares, because one's longing for the truth is the true longing, not in a grasping sense, but because it is a must, you can't help it. If it is a case of you can't help it, then out of your own being there will emerge vision. The dust which covers my eyes will get removed. And you will find that in that process, this indescribable thing, happiness, joy, is there. And with it, an extraordinary comfort. Comfort which has no relationship to consolation and that sort of stuff, but which is the strength of the soul from within. And the strength of the soul from within is the real meaning of the word virtue. Then virtue flows out naturally. You don't have to strive for it and acquire it. Because what we strive for in order to acquire for ourselves is always the half-baked thing, the incomplete thing, the ill thing, in other words. Now, this, do try and understand this point. Spend the whole fortnight with this and really get hold of it. That if there is complete, total, intense attention to any one thing which is troublesome, you see, miserliness or cruelty or inconsiderateness or whatever it is, you see, you are free of that as well as its opposite. And then the virtue which flows out is the inner strength of your own soul, which is now unimpeded. It just flows out freely. And that's comfort. Con fortis, with strength. I keep on saying con fortis, but it is fors fortis. Fortis is the genitive case. Comfort means that. And if you are in the state of comfort, whosoever comes to you in trouble, you can be a comfort unto them. It's your influence which is the comfort. Supposing a little trouble arises in the street, a few drunks get together and start fighting or some such thing, and you are in danger of, supposing you have a strong man beside you, you are at rest. Isn't it? It's like that. Now, another point. If you can do this in relation to any one thing, say cruelty or violence, not only will you be free of the ambivalence of violence and non-violence, you will be free of all ambivalence. It's the extraordinary thing. One virtue, in its transcendent sense, is every virtue. Because it is virtue, unnamed. It's the power of your healthy soul. The whole sphere of ambivalence vanishes. And your eyes are opened. You have seen the light. And everything is lighted up. Supposing I walk into this room before the sun has risen and everything is still dark, you see. And I try to see in the very, very dim light that is still available in the room one particular object. Well, I might be able to see it. So I draw the curtains. Now what happens? Every object gets seen. You pay complete, intense attention to any one thing. And when that intensity lights that fire which completely burns away the dross, with any one thing, the whole job gets done. I've put it in these terms. The Greeks made Hercules just turn that river and cleaned out the whole of the Augean stables. Not just corners. He didn't go shh, shh, shh with a hose, hose pipe, cleaning out every corner. Not at all. He just turned that river round. The stables were completely swept out. And this, I dare say, is one of its deep meanings. The cleaning of the Augean stables. You must understand this. Really understand it. So that when you set to the task and do it, you do it with wisdom and not in the spirit of grasping the pleasant result. Because that will inevitably spell defeat. That is, it's impossible to do it if there is any grasping. Ah, at last I've discovered the secret of happiness and the way to it. Now I'm going to do it and I shall be happy ever afterwards. We just come down with a bump if we approach the matter that way. You know why? Such realization is not like attaining a static goal. In our affairs in life, all our objectives are static objectives. See? I save up £10 a week in order after, 150 weeks, I can buy a good Steinway. All right. Having made the effort, week after week, saved up this £10 a week, I have the £1,500 or whatever it is, whatever the price of the Steinway is, to buy the Steinway. Having bought it, it's finished now. But life is a continuous process. And the psyche is expressing its psycheness, its psychological life, continuously. It's like the body. You can't say, oh, I shall eat enough today to last me for the next 3 years. It's just impossible. It's a rhythm. It's a rhythm of movement. So too with psyche, so too with the spirit. Use what word you like. It's a continuous thing. So the mindfulness, the attentiveness remains alert all the time. But once having realized this extraordinary transformation, the very first time, the attentiveness is sort of master of the situation. And remains like that. So you see, people talk of sudden illumination. And you know, most of the people who talk of sudden illumination and oh, they're going to be liberated, think of some marvelous colored flash going to come somewhere, you know, like these photographs which are taken with a flashlight kind of thing. Well, that illumination goes just as quickly as the flashlight disappears after it has been lit. It isn't a continuous light like the light of the sun. This is what we have to remember. Now this attentiveness is maintained not by struggling to maintain it. Because one cares, this extraordinary energy from within comes out and keeps the light of attention burning, undimmed. It's a searchlight which sees everything clearly. But the two have to go together, the caring and the attention. Do not for a moment think that this means that will be the end of physical discomfort or pain or the pressures of life. They are everlastingly there. Buddhas and Christs equally retired into the mountain or into the forest in order to have a somewhat easy circumstance for recuperating from the pressure of life. This is a fact. But whilst, especially in our modern world, we have little power to choose our circumstance, the more welfare-y the welfare state, the harder you've got to work and the greater is the anxiety for keeping up with Mr. and Mrs. Welfare. It's no longer the Joneses, it's Mr. and Mrs. Welfare. You see? So let's have no illusions about it. And yet, if you really see, the resources from within will be yours to use. Now, be very wise, which is the same as saying be very practical about all this. You remember some months ago when we were talking about relationship with persons, we considered this point that I, the individual, the separate I, the individual, can never deliberately set out to put it right with another. Because if I deliberately set out that way, I make a picture of what the relationship ought to be. Obviously, isn't it? My friend John Brown, He doesn't come to see me anymore. He's got a little bit annoyed. Well, let me put it right with him. I know, I think I must have, because I said such and such a thing last time I saw him, he's been offended. I'll put it right with him. You make a shape. All right, you may apologize for the thing that you have said which offended him. But at the back of your mind is the idea that he should behave towards me according to this pattern which pleased me until then. And that's where the mistake comes. We calculate. But the realm of truth, the realm of reality is the incalculable realm. The petty little plans of mice and men are so ridiculous. If you find great difficulty, turn to Shakespeare. Midsummer Night's Dream. Remember Puck's words, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." Meditate on it. Understand it. I am a fool. I'm a bigger and a bigger fool, the more and more I try to be clever. But if I can be a pure fool, just let go and see that, yes, I don't know, I can't do anything about it as a separate I. Lo and behold, your folly will turn into wisdom. Because within the pure fool is all the sweetness and simplicity and spontaneity of the child, the happy, healthy child. And it will come out. So now, we must bear in mind that we must not approach the whole thing in terms of putting it right. Because if I want to put it right, apart from just the vague words put it right, if I think out, I'll put it right this way and that way, then I shall always be wrong in the long run. In the end, it will always be wrong. It is life which lives me. It is life, the totality, which must be allowed free flow through this which is called me, the psychophysical organism. And in order that there may be free flow, there must be no obstruction within the organism. The organism has to become pure, simple. And the way of purity is this way of attention. Complete attention, complete understanding. No struggle involved there. The question arises, but surely one must make a tremendous effort to be attentive. At first it is like that. But you will find that if there is even a little bit of real caring already within you, which means real love, the pure passion, the divine passion for it, then the attention will naturally be there. And it will be there naturally in increasing measure. The attentiveness and the caring will grow together. If you've been fortunate enough in your lifetime to have something, maybe a hobby, maybe some art, some particular skill, in which you are disinterestedly, dispassionately concerned, you see, then it is love which makes the thing go. It's pure love. You love doing the thing. Your hobby is calligraphy, and you just love it so much that you write beautiful and make sheer beauty, sheer joy. It cannot be bought, it's not for sale. It is there. Now you see, the fulfillment of life is like that. And that is happiness. And as the Buddha pointed out, the supreme happiness comes when there is the cessation of this separatist perception and feeling. Whether it be on the common garden plane of everyday existence, or whether it be on the transcendent level that the Buddha is talking of. Then there is the plunge into nirvana, the indescribable, the real kingdom of heaven. Then transcendence is no longer a word. It is the simple, actual reality here now. It is no longer there, tomorrow, 1,000 lives hence, and all that pettifogging stuff. It's here, now. That transcendent real is here, now. It is I who shut it out. If you like to use the Sufi Christian terminology, the grace of God is here all the time. It is I who push it out. But this is the love of God, the divine love, which will not impose or compel that grace upon us or thrust it down our throats. No. It waits timelessly. It lives in eternity. It never was born, it will never die. An eternal reality. And this is something which can only be real for us in terms of a pure and a free psyche. It is a psychological truth which can be realized in consciousness, not a physical truth. There's no physical, of course. Therefore, whether we live in a physical circumstance of pleasure or pain, ease or terrible discomfort or whatever it is, this psychological reality is there, undisturbed. So, have we understood the essential points then? First, to grasp that we live within this, to understand that we live within this ambivalent sphere, this duality, that all our conceptions of virtue and vice are really misconceptions. The next thing to do, or when I say next, I mean in order of talking about it, it all happens simultaneously. The next thing to do is to see that pure, intense attention upon any one aspect of the dual, whether it be commonly called good, you can choose not to concentrate attention upon violence or cruelty or villainy or anything. You can choose kindness, generosity, all the so-called acceptable things. Really attend to it totally, and you become free of the entire sphere of ambivalence. Not only with respect to this particular duality, but with respect to all duality. Because the transformation is the transformation in your consciousness. These qualities which we attach to the psyche are not, as in the case of the body, separate organs like the liver and the heart and the kidneys or the blood or the bones or the flesh or the skin or anything like that. They are not separate things. It's one psyche, one energy, which because of the pressures upon it, from without as well as from within, takes this shape or that shape, a pleasant shape or an unpleasant shape, a hurtful shape or a soothing shape. See? So, we are free of the whole of duality that way. Then one remains mindful, and the remaining mindful, intensely mindful, is associated with intense caring. One cares. It is better to leave it at that. The state of caring. Don't say caring for the religious life. Loving God. Well, when you say loving God, you're separating God out from the other gentleman who flourishes a great deal everywhere. They are one and the same. They are not different. In the esoteric teaching, the serpent that tempts Eve is Yahweh himself in disguise. So you see, life in itself is rich in power, in hope. Hope of the right sort. I mean, not this thing, oh, I hope I shall win the derby next year. Not that sort of stuff and nonsense. But the hopefulness, which is the sort of youthfulness of life energy, that is there. You look at a child, it's full of hope because it's full of youthful vigor, isn't it? Hope springs eternal in the human breast, as the poet said. How does it spring eternal? Unless it is an eternal reality. It's an eternal energy. It's there. Just one other point. Through the centuries, very fine men, saints and seers alike, have practiced and have taught what may be called the desirability of special ways, of a method, of a technique of prayer, meditation, of holy living. But they have presented all this as if in contrast to the worldly life and so forth. The true meaning of the negation of the worldly life, the denial to oneself of what is worldly, the true meaning is being completely free of the enclosing influence of the worldly consciousness. This is what it is. And the worldly consciousness is one which makes the person function in terms of attachment and aversion, in terms of conflict. There is no freedom, there is no liberation. Now, this does not mean that if and when there is the circumstance, there is the natural urge, it's the natural thing that is going to happen, go through a specific form of meditation or deep prayer or contemplation or anything. All right, go for it. But be awake to the wholeness. Don't enter the sanctuary with the feeling, this is the sanctuary, shutting out that which is not the sanctuary. I say here now, wheresoever you may stand, it is the sanctuary, it is holy ground. No place is not holy ground. It is I who am unholy. And if I, the unholy, stand upon any ground, that ground is unholy, rendered unholy. It's this separativeness, this denial of the wholeness, which is the trouble. So see the wholeness, because that is holiness. There, if you like, perhaps is something of a key to salvation. Not your salvation or my salvation, but to salvation, to the self's condition, the healthy, whole, holy condition.